Hello, and welcome to Be Creator, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the creator economy. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Be Creator, formerly known as Blogosphere. Be Creator are the UK specialists in creator events. We run category-specific shows, such as the Beauty, Travel, and Health and Wellbeing Creator Show, which bring together brands, talent managers, and creators for a day of exhibitions, panels, presentations, and networking. And we also run the Be Creator Awards, our flagship event, which celebrates the best UK creators and creator marketing campaigns of the year. Last year's event had a reach of 179 million. If you would like to see some information about our events and how to get involved, head over to becreator.co.uk. Now, onto the show. Today on Be Creator, Serious Influence, I'm joined by Esme Rice, who is Global Influencer Practice Lead at Mindshare.
I'm Esme Rice. I am the Influencer Practice Lead at Mindshare.
Now, let's have a little bit of a look at your career and how you got to where you are today. So what was your first role and when did you first come into the world of creator?
My first role and the first time I kind of came into creator was actually at Social Chain. I did an internship. I emailed Hannah Anderson, who's one of the founders.
She's now at Kymer. Is she managing?
Kairos. She's done some great group of founders there who went off all to do amazing things.
So was it Dominic McGregor, Stephen Bartlett and Hannah?
Yes. Yeah. And then you had Kira, who was their famous head of happiness. She's gone off to create a really great cafe with her partner now.
So, amazing.
And they've got married, which was really lovely to see. Michael Heaven, I run into every now and again. He went off to launch their US business and now works with a virtual influencer called Zero by Nexus, which is really cool. Mm. Lots of really interesting stuff coming from the Social Chain group. Yeah. And it was really nice. Like I joined them when there was probably about 60 people. So it was quite like...
What year was that?
Oh, God. Playing my age now. 2016?
Yeah. So they launched in 2014.
Yeah. It was in, when they were still in their Manchester, Portland Street offices.
I think those are the offices we went to when we interviewed Stephen in 2017. Actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Is there a slide in the corner?
Yes, the famous slide. And I worked there with Nick Crompton, who went on to be the MD of Team 10.
Right.
And Becca Sharples, and they were the two within
Social
Chain at the time that were running the influencer talent side of the business.
What's happened to Team 10 now? Is that... Because that's Jake Paul, Team 10.
Not
Logan, that was Maverick.
Yes, but I believe they're all still... I think kind of like the Sidemen and all those groups still existing as an entity, but not quite as heavily.
Not living in the same house.
Not living in the same house, not heavily as pushed and controlled. I think each influencer kind of ended up.
Jake's sort of doing the boxing.
Yes.
More.
Yes. Tommy Fury, lost KSI.
Tommy Fury. Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's a fascinating space that, intelligent, but I'm kind of like, what's the longevity of it?
Well, I didn't stay awake to watch it, but I did. The first thing I did in the morning was to check who had won.
I did stay up to watch
did
it.
Did you?
I got angry emails from my neighbour, my wall neighbour.
Oh, wow. Did you? Was that pay-per-view then that you...
Yes. Yeah.
How much was the pay-per-view?
I think it was like 20 quid.
Interesting. Because I think I did pay-per-view for the Logan KSI fight.
Valid, yeah.
I feel like that was more around like 10, but I think they did 10 million in revenue from it.
The numbers that they're getting, I think when they were doing it early on, 2-3 years ago, when it was a new concept, I think now people are realizing that there's that, like, you know, the script was leaked or they know that there's going to be a rematch, or they're just brothers fighting brothers and, you know, KSI, JJ, Logan.
Yeah, there was that... Well, it wasn't the script thing, but I gather that was sort of fake news. But.
Yes, script was leaked, but was it leaked? Who knows, kind of thing. I mean...
Controversial, because Eddie Hearn got involved in the second Logan Paul KSI fight, but he seems to have taken a step back from YouTube boxing now, I think.
We've gone straight into
Right, let's go back. So you start your internship.
I start my internship at Social Chain.
How long was the internship?
It was a month, and then I had an internship lined up straight afterwards to go to Saatchi & Saatchi for a couple of weeks, and I was like, oh my God, I really want to stay at Social Chain, but like such and such age should go and experience it. So I went for 2 weeks to go work in their PR team there, which was really interesting, and like gained loads of experience, and basically was a deck designer for some stuff for a few weeks. And then when I left, I was like, right, I'm getting back in touch, and I ended up freelancing for them whilst I was at university. So whilst I finished off my degree, I worked for Social Chain.
What was your degree in?
Marketing at Durham. So on the nose. And I decided to write my dissertation on influencer marketing. And I used my dissertation to interview people that I wanted to work for when I finished my dissertation.
Clever.
Yeah, so I could email them and be like, hello. Mark Dandy, Ellie Herneman from Truffle, which has done amazing since, and of course Harry Hugo from Goat.
Uh-huh.
So wrote my dissertation, finished all of that off.
So you freelanced for Social Chain, but you didn't go back there, you went to Goat.
Yes, so I graduated. So I Social Chain, the account that I was working on, it was a new social platform that was trying to launch specifically for students. And I think basically they realized kind of the idea was kind of not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
But I was a content creator for that channel. Okay. So my job was to make content for this social media platform.
Was that a Facebook page?
It was a whole new social media platform.
Oh, sorry,
specifically for students.
Oh.
That they were trying to get. I can't remember. Wait,
that was an account. That was.
Yeah, that was the account I was working on. And so I was hired as an influencer to work on and create the content. And I had like the most followed cooking channel on there at the time was making these terrible protein pancakes whilst going to the gym every day. That were honestly, if anyone followed my recipes, I apologize now for the recipes I gave you. They must have been terrible. No wonder I stopped freelancing. I left and then I moved to Goat. Yeah.
Just thinking, you mentioned, that didn't go anywhere. What's happening with Stereo? Did you do anything with Stereo? Do you remember? That was suddenly huge for a while.
It did happen. Yeah. I think this conversation is a hint of what happened with that.
Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately.
True. So then you started Goat, and what was your role there? And were you living in Manchester or?
No, so I lived in Manchester when I did my internship.
Yeah.
Then I moved up to Durham to do my freelancing. And then I moved to Brick Lane and started working at the Goat agency when they were based in. It was our Old Street offices at that point.
What was that experience like? Where are you from originally?
I'm from St Albans originally, but I've lived like in most of the cities in the north, basically. So it's not too crazy to move around within England.
Yeah. And so this was Goat offices in Old Street. What year are we in now?
I think probably 2018 then.
Because I'm trying to think when they were founded. Because they were at Sport Lobster before?
Yes. So Nick, Aaron and Harry were at Sport Lobster. Aaron was a founding partner there. Nick was within their accountancy team, I think. Sorry, Nick, don't quote me on that.
This is Nick Cook.
Nick Cook, yes.
Aaron Shepherd, Harry Hugo.
Yes, and Harry Hugo was one of their up and running social guys within the team. Had been working on blogs and been doing some really great stuff. And the story that they always kind of told about Sport Lobster and Goat and moving on, the only reason I know this is because I told this story over and over again for 2 years, was that they worked with some micro-influencers at Sport Lobster through Harry, through some of his Twitter pages within the sporting world, and they ended up paying the same amount to those micro-influencers that they did to
Ronaldo,
that's it, yeah, Ronaldo, and they got basically 100 times the results with the micro influencers, naturally. So as we all kind of see that higher conversion with smaller creators, especially back then when you were activating them effectively. They went off and they realized the power of this, and they realized the power of going and creating an influencer agency, and the three of them set up Goat.
How many, when you joined, how many people were there roughly?
I was number 24 through the door.
And now what are they, sort of 150?
Oh, yeah, 120, 150, yeah. Launched in Singapore, New York. Doing some really great work since. Yeah, it was kind of crazy to be with them during that growth journey, when to join them at that point when they kind of already had that founding team and that philosophy, and then just through that massive growth where I think by the time I'd left, they were Europe's fastest growing agency. Wow. Not just influencer agency, fastest growing of all agencies.
Amazing. And were you there before the vlog? Had the vlog started?
Yes, I was there. I was there on the Friday when Harry came out to me. And he was like, made a decision. I was like, okay. It's like, we're gonna film a vlog. And I was like, right. And I was like, it's gonna be a daily vlog. And it started out as being the 4:59. And we were going to do 4:59 a day. Right. And if you've ever edited a video, but trying to make it 4:59 every day, very difficult.
So were you involved in the editing of that, or coming up with the concepts of what should be filmed, you know?
Yeah. So at GOAT, I was a marketing manager. So reporting and working very closely directly in with Harry. And doing everything from website SEO, our Google ads, doing our social media, including the vlog, doing all of our award entries. I look back now and I'm like, how did I
manage to do it?
they got some great years there. But it's just great.
You kind
fun,
of get lost in the adrenaline of it though, don't you, when it's so fast paced. It's like,
absolutely. And I was learning so much and given so much responsibility, which was amazing. I was there on the Friday when Harry came up to me. He was like, we're gonna start a vlog. And I was like, right. And he was like, can you buy the equipment?
Because Stephen had his vlog though, didn't he? Daily Steve.
Yes.
Daily Stephen.
Yeah.
Daily Steve. And then I think I may have been on a LinkedIn post or something of Harry's, that for the first year, the vlog didn't actually bring in new business, and then suddenly it made up like 50% of new leads or something.
Yeah, it wasn't really bringing in, like, it was more kind of us establishing ourselves and having an idea of what we were doing and what we were talking about.
For brand awareness though, it must have been...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely massive. Like the ads and the interest and the people who watched it were really interested in, like, the community that we built around it was really, really great and really strong.
Mm. I suppose pandemic wasn't ideal because it was so much about the office, wasn't it? And office life. I know that it carried on. Is it still going now? Because
I believe they've bought it back.
Okay.
They do have a studio now, and they've done some shooting within that studio, and I think they've turned it more into, you know, also a client service as well, which is great to be able to offer, you know, that production in house when you need that professional level of production, which is really great. I believe that Matt, who was the kind of person behind the screen, who was just a wonderful character, just a great person all around, I believe he's left now, but when they went into the pandemic, I think they had to kind of shift and change gear.
Yeah, office life just provides content quite easily rather than having to...
Naturally, yeah. I mean, you shove a load of people that are like an average age of 21 in an office space together.
In
what used to be, I think it was Bloomberg's offices, like in this huge open office space, and give them free reign with a camera. You're going to get some entertainment.
Have they gone back to an office now, do you know? Or is it fully remote? Because I feel like I hear quite a lot is now fully remote.
Yeah, I think quite a lot of places are. And I think especially with these influencer agencies and young agent and like social media leaning agencies, that people are looking to go fully remote to get kind of the best talent.
Okay, to get the best talent.
I think there's a lot more acceptance within neurodiversity and within ways of working, and the pandemic has shed light that not everyone needs to be in the office to be productive.
Yeah.
So
definitely in terms of productivity, but what you did mention earlier was how much you learnt, like being around.
Yes.
Which is some of those, you know, you pick up things just by observing as opposed to having to schedule in a call with like the CEO. If you're a junior, it would be quite more,
The amount of face-to-face time definitely within those few years was definitely very, very formative.
Yeah. So marketing manager, being very involved, kind of reporting into Harry, what did you speak to clients and sort of educate them? How much was education part of the process?
Yeah, education was a big part of it. It was about, because at the time, especially we're talking like 5-6 years ago now, when we kicked off, was, you know, I mean, I wrote my dissertation on why micro-influencers are effective and was told by my lecturer at the time, don't write a dissertation on influencers because it's going to be gone in a few years. And we were still fighting, like at that point the conversation was, I'm sure you remember, the bubble's going to burst, no it's not, it's a wild west, like here's the best way to do it. And it was literally defining what influencer marketing is and creating those ideas of what it is and how it works. And then and then
allowing people to realize that, you know, brand safety and all of these things.
Yeah, definitely.
What were the biggest sort of questions that came up to you from clients or in this education piece? What were you asked the most, would you say?
I mean, how do I do it? How do I manage it? Can you just manage it for me? was a lot of it.
That's probably the exact result, though.
Yeah. How much should I pay my influencers? I think is a consistent question because it's something that's constantly changing. Which ad formats, which platforms are right for me? Should I jump on this trend? Should I jump on that trend?
What sort of budgets were you seeing at that time? And I have heard that there has been a slight tightening of budgets across the board. So is it plateauing?
I think that when we were looking like 6 years ago, we were looking at 10, 20, you know, 30, 40, moving up. I think about 3-4 years ago, I know Goat at least introduced a 40K minimum budget per month, and other agencies kind of took suit with that kind of thing. I think at the time, if we're talking UK agencies as well here.
Mm. US
is obviously going to have probably about like 1.5, 2 times at least of that. But also we saw this difference of people looking at their influencer budgets instead of on a campaign by campaign basis as
retainer.
And
with the, you know, 40K minimum month on month, was there a point where it was only, we will only book if it's at least a 6 month retainer, like we're not going to work on just a one-off campaign?
No, they were still doing like 1 month off campaigns or, you know, a couple of months. I mean, the ideal was that you would end up working with those influencers, building a network and do that over time, because the more learnings that you get about a client, the more data that you can get. Because also remember, we're building the data in this industry.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know, as these things are changing, as social changing, as we get a new client with a different type of audience and USP, we're gaining new data. So as much as you're trying to work with them and just make sure that they get what they want for that one-off campaign and make sure you hit those deliverables, you do want that kind of long-term relationship with them.
What was your favorite client that you worked with during that time, like best campaign
in terms of the agency and who the agency worked with? Formula E did some really fantastic work. They did that for 2 years. The second year, they did a live YouTube show from the YouTube studios with the Sidemen kind of acting as hosts. Went out and did. It was a really nice balance of big creators and then also smaller creators on the ground.
Was Casey Neistat involved with that? I feel like I saw him come over for a Formula E something.
I believe he was on the ground there. I don't know if he wasn't through Goat, I believe. Okay. Emirata was one of ours that we had out there, which was really cool. And because I was working more on the editing, video production side of things, I also did a bit of work with Nico Rosberg, which was really nice. And Charlie Thomas, who's gone out there to work with him now. I edited Nico Rosberg's podcast a couple of times with Ross Edgley.
Okay.
The guy who swam around the channel.
Wow.
Which was like, well, we swam around the entirety of the UK. Yeah, yeah. And that was like just, I mean, that at the time, I think I was like 22, 23, sat in the room, and I was like, why am I here?
Imposter syndrome.
Oh, yeah, always.
I think because the industry is so new, though, you know, you go in and do an internship at Social Chain, you're going to know more than, you know, people picking it up later, kind of live and breathe it. So how long were you at Goat for?
Just over 2 years.
And then you moved to Taylorfy.
Yeah, then I moved to Taylorfy.
And the role there was
marketing director. Yeah, so again, reporting in another influencer agency set up by three men. again, reporting into one of the guys there, Frederick Martini Anderson, who everyone they, so they're Frederick and Didrik.
Really?
Yeah. So to make it easy, there's Frederick Anderson is Martini, Frederick Segeby is Segeby, and Didrik is Didrik.
Is it a data platform? How would it describe itself? Is it influence marketing agency, Taylorfy?
Yeah, so it started out as kind of more of a, when I joined, it was, they were looking at behavioural science and data to some level in terms of what they were doing. And they're very much an academic-based company, very much like big influencer nerds.
Yeah.
Which is just a fantastic like environment to come into, people just really interested in the subject and talking about the nitty gritty of it all. And then
did it have the creative edge as well? So it's, you've got like data heavy, but
yeah, but it was, I think because the creative was led by the data, you end up kind of recreating some of the same kind of creative concepts. But if it worked, like, and it, that's what it kind of seemed to do when they were working with consistent types of brands and things, it seemed to, you know, really work well, the creative strategies that they were coming up with.
What sort of clients did they have?
Oh, you're testing me now. I'm trying to see if I can remember some of them. Just Eat was a big one. I'm also trying to remember which ones that they are allowed to speak about. yeah, Just Eat is one of their biggest ones that they were kind of working on and doing some cool stuff with.
Have you found, having worked at Goat, Tailorfy and now Mindshare, that, well, particularly with Tailorfy and Goat, that when they have a client, that they have exclusivity with that client? Or do things move around quite a lot? Because I know in the US it's very much in on brief yeah. by brief. But here there's maybe some more like loyalty, or like, if a retainer, would it be a year retainer, or could you sign on?
It's an interesting one, because as you say, in the US they tend to have, they'll have like put three different out, yeah. influencer agencies going at one time, and they're just like, oh, we just like to pick, you know. In the UK they seem to have a bit more consistency. Saying that, NordVPN is one of Tailorfy's, you know, longest standing partners within their work, and Nord working with a couple of different agencies as well. I think it just comes down to the fact of the space is moving a lot and people are testing out different agencies. Mm. But generally people were working on kind of, yeah, year-long contracts or longer campaign yeah. contracts.
Do you think sometimes agencies want to keep who their client, some of who's on their client roster, like quiet? But then also you sort of, if you're going to win new business, you need to know what.
Sure. Sometimes it's the other way around. Especially okay. when I first started out, some of the clients didn't want us to register them on our website. Mm. They didn't want to be known as a brand that was doing influencer marketing. But I think as we, as agencies, educated them on ethical transparency and about disclosure and using ad and things like that, once that really started developing, that's where we started being like, no, like, it doesn't matter if you won't let us list you on our website or whatever, but you need to do all the disclosures. So I think once people start taking proper disclosure seriously and transparency, as they have done in the last few years.
Yeah. Well, then it's professionalized the space and it's legitimized it in a way, hasn't it?
Yeah, which I think it can only be a great thing. I know that there were some really great, fast, easy wins for people 6-7 years ago, but to really get people and the investment and the industry around influencers, that I really think there can be, and get that sustainable and good growth into it, we have to be protecting and putting guardrails around our stakeholders to protect them. And whether that's protecting our influencers with proper payment and with proper education on how they can work, whether it's educating our brands on how they need to be you know, managing their relationships with influencers, or work discussing with our agencies, you know, you need to be fostering these relationships. And
you touched there on letting creators know, you know, how much they should be charging as sort of a level of transparency. Is that sort of campaign to campaign, do you think there needs to be more done on a sort of public stage, so that creators who maybe aren't at a level where it's 100% professionalized yet, but are getting there, where they can get this information from? Because there are pay gaps, you know, there's disparity.
There absolutely are pay gaps and disparity. We see that in, you know, almost every industry really, but with influencers specifically, I think because it, as you say, it's that freelancer perspective of, you know, if you think about it as a media space, you're not buying a billboard from someone that's going to get X amount of people walking in front of it. You're buying that person's time, their changing audience, their relationship with their audience, their emotional toll, their trust, yeah, the work that they're putting in. They could be someone that does really nice aesthetic imagery, or someone that does a full-on YouTube vlog throughout the week and drops in brand mentions throughout, like, or, you know, or they show up to your events, or they're a year-long, like, there are so many different ways that we can work with influencers that it's really difficult to start banding them and being like, well, if you have X, you should be charging this much for your influencer campaign. Because that's what we started doing. We're saying, oh, if you've got 10,000 followers, we'll pay
you
X. Trying
to do standardization, yeah.
And it just kind of just doesn't work. So I think, yeah, education around it, people being very transparent about it. There are some great pages out there. You know, we're in the era of information. You know, information is out there. We can have free conversations and be talking about it and be talking about...
Do you think that maybe speaking to talent managers is a way, do you know, is there enough... Because people can be a bit protective, so maybe there needs to be greater conversations between talent management agencies. Did you find it educating them or getting feedback and, you know, comparing rates, be like, look, we've had this offer, you're actually underselling your talent here? Or
yeah, I think that that kind of fostering that kind of conversations is really important to just have that open benchmarking or open ideas of how much you're paying. And I think no one's actually really known sometimes like how much they're paying their influencers, if they're going through agencies, if they're doing, you know, having that cost transparency, having that fee transparency is a really great thing to work towards that I think that we can all do.
Yeah.
And just having that, yeah, that open, honest conversation. Because also we can't avoid that this is going to be a gender and race issue, that there are people that won't have the skills and the abilities to advocate for themselves.
Yeah.
They will see within their circles that that's how much they get paid. And it's just, it's the role of the person who's paying and to be working with these people to make sure that we're negotiating properly. And by negotiating properly, I don't mean just trying to pay the less.
Yeah,
like, you know, you've had brands coming up to you and being like, over the last few years, being like, oh, yeah, we didn't even have to pay those influencers. And you're just like, no.
Yeah.
Like,
there's no future in the market if that's how you're...
Exactly, exactly. It's like, you wouldn't say that about the people that work for your business.
Yeah.
Please don't say it about the people who are putting over their platform that they've put,
and many roles in one as well,
years of work into. Yeah.
How did you find the transition then from going from, well, Social Chain, Goat, Tailify, all influence marketing specialists, to going to a bigger organization?
Yes.
I don't know how old Mindshare is, but many people so yeah, how did you, what made you want to go to something?
It's a really good point, and it's definitely something I asked myself when I was kind of looking at the role, because I wasn't looking to leave Tailify or to leave the influencer marketing industry at all. In fact, when I left Go, I thought, oh, I can't possibly work for another influencer agency. So for 6 weeks, I went to a creative gaming agency before I got roped back into influencer marketing. Like, it's basically as quickly as I left, I came back. So I was like, oh, God, I won't leave influencer marketing. I won't leave that specialist space, because that's where I am. Mm. That's my entire life. And when I saw the role and when I saw the opportunity, it just looked so interesting. But I had massive imposter syndrome about applying for it. I was gonna pull out. Like, I was gonna pull
out.
What
is the job? What is the title of your?
So the title when I joined was Director Global Influence Marketing, and now it's changed to Director Global Influence Global Influencer Practice Lead.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's such a different space to what I've been in before. But I think there's always been this really interesting conversation around how the influencer marketing industry and the agencies have evolved, and how they've kind of evolved on the side as kind of a hack through, like, to go under the platforms instead of going through the platforms. You're not working with Facebook to run the campaigns on, you know, you're working under them. It isn't really till a few years ago that we saw paid really coming into influencer agency space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's meant that media agencies and influencer agencies have kind of now met in the middle.
Yeah.
But there's a huge opportunity and huge space, and it just seemed like such a great challenge and a great opportunity to bring in, you know, I put it in my CV. I wrote, like, I'm a marketing generalist and influencer marketing specialist.
Mm.
Like, I can do you know, I can do podcasts, I can write you an award entry, I can,
yeah,
you know, do a SEO ad, I'm a jack of all trades there, master of none. But then influencer marketing specialist, just absolute nerd about it. It's, you know, it's what I think about, it's what I talk about. It's, as you say, we kind of went off on tangents at the start, yeah, of this, and it's because, like, you know, we can literally sit here and talk about it all the time. So to be able to come into a space like Mindshare, and be able to work with the minds there, the people with such a great and varied experience. Like, when I went in, I didn't know anything about kind of like connected TV or kind of things like that. I was like, I know what those are, but like, I've never worked on that or seen that or seen on such a huge scale as well. So
do people come to, you know, how does your role sort of influence practice lead work? Do you go, an ongoing brief is there, and then they bring you in to advise on an influencer as part of the campaign?
Yeah. So that's definitely one part of it, is working and being that kind of specialist that consults on those bigger strategy briefs that come into our global team or our sometimes our local teams. And then those get cascaded and sent out to everyone. So the kind of three parts. So that's one part. Another part is general best practice, how to, you know, work with influencers, how do we engage with them, how do we think about them from, you know, throughout every stage of the process.
Yeah.
And then also, to a degree, there's a part of my role that's looking at which agencies are we working with, what's the tech that's available, how are we, you know, structuring our approach.
So do you work with then quite a few influencer agencies as well?
Yeah, there's loads of influencer agencies in the space, and when you think about the different Mindshare clients that we have, they've all kind of selected different agencies and people within the space.
Do they run some of it just themselves though as well on the influencer side, or is it mainly outsourcing?
Some of it's run ourselves. It's such a big mix, because we're in what, like 38 markets. Unilever, my client, have about 400 brands, you know, so so when we're talking about like what they will do, I literally cannot even summarize it, because there's different people doing different things. The other day,
Unilever's office is quite a bit than meeting the teams there.
Do you know what? I went to the Amsterdam Netherlands office before I even went to the London office.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're constantly chatting and like having conversations, but I think because it was all post-pandemic world, it's just super virtual.
Do you do any of like creative kind of strategy within Mindshare as well, or is it mainly just the paid?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we do like a bit, so it kind of comes into as you have to think about it and you have to be kind of thinking about these creative concepts. But it's actually something I've really interestingly noticed when I come into the media space, is that creative means something completely different in this space than it does in influencer. Sorry, I can say when I come from influencer agency land.
No,
I didn't work for influencer. I feel like I've worked for every other influencer agency, basically.
They managed to get that name, yeah. I think everyone's worked for them.
The great SEO on that name, honestly. Yeah. It always made me jealous. Genius moves there. So within influencers, and what makes influencers so wonderful and amazing, is that we're working with them to create the content and to kind of collaborate on that creative process.
Yeah.
So in terms of creative, it kind of ends up becoming this collaborative piece between us as the wider media agency advising on the entire piece, that holistic comms planning piece, the creative agency who might be creating, you know, the concept and the pieces and video assets for other platforms, and then the influencers and the influencer teams who are then passing over that creative brief to then adapt it best to fit on their channels. You know, we always like to make sure, as everyone will know hopefully listening to this podcast, that we like creators to have that control over what content gets made and posted out on their channels. So for me, creative sits as a balance and as a collaborative piece of the process.
In terms of the platforms that you're seeing clients want to use, has there been a rise, for instance, in the amount of campaigns that they want to be running on TikTok versus YouTube? What are your views on the platforms? Where do you think budget should be being spent? And seeing the news at the moment, there's the potential for TikTok to be banned in the US. It's been banned on government devices in the UK.
Yeah. It's so I mean, definitely TikTok. I mean, obviously that's on everyone's lips at the moment.
And are you feeling that it converts well for clients as well, TikTok? Is it brand awareness pieces they're doing? But
yeah. So I mean, TikTok itself, I think obviously Influencer Marketing Hub does a wonderful report every year on statistics and things like that, and was looking at the most popular platforms within influencer campaigns, and TikTok for the first time overtook Instagram. I think it was like 55.5% of people running influencer campaigns were using TikTok.
Maybe Instagram just got too expensive for the campaigns that were running on it, or?
Yeah, I mean, look, people are definitely still using Instagram. I think that's definitely like a key feature. But yeah, I mean, the cost, and also I think the organic reach that you're getting through Instagram is just not as high. Mm. That doesn't mean that other platforms can't turn around and, you know, do the same to you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen Kylie Jenner this week, where she put up a branded TikTok, a collaboration, and it got like 10,000 likes.
Really?
Yeah, and we're talking someone who has about 50 million followers there.
Wow.
So yeah, it's not definite that you're going to get organic reach with TikTok, but it's definitely, you know.
How do those conversations go with a client when, you know, you've put forward a creator and then you get a return like that? What's the process? What's damage control?
You know, what if a piece doesn't do well, or if that kind of creative concept doesn't do well, I think that that's when you're then having a conversation, and that's where you really need those specialists on the ground to have that analytical perspective to look at the content itself, and look at it in the bigger picture, have that data perspective of what's happened, why it's happened.
Mm. With the campaigns that you were working on or overseeing, being involved with in some capacity, at Goat and Tailify, were there... Did clients, you know, with the guarantees, so you'd have to put paid behind it afterwards, is that something that's sort of built into contracts, how the contracts developed?
I think so. I mean, in terms of contracts with the clients, there was always then the deliverables of what Goat was always known for, guaranteeing deliverables and being able to hit those through their own efficiencies. And it was really a challenge to themselves to see, you know, let's make sure we can hit this, let's do this for the client. And then,
do you think that's been taken on by other agencies as well?
I think so. I think there are also some that everyone has a different approach. There are some that come at it and they go, you know, approach it a bit more from like a PR perspective of like, oh, it's a bit more wishy-washy what the deliverables will be, but we're going to do this really cool creative concept. And people have all come at it from different angles. Yeah. I mean, there's 1,000 different influencer agencies out there.
So many.
Each have their own kind of perspective. So I'm sure that some will have taken on the guaranteed deliverables part. But in terms, back to your point about whether, yeah, those pieces having the organic reach for the deliverables and then getting, you know, amplified with paid, it's a great technique to be able to make sure that you're really making the most out of your content.
Yeah.
You know, we always want to be securing our usage rights with all of our creators, checking in with them. It's a great reason why we need to have a great relationship with our influencers, because I always use the example, this hasn't happened to me, but I don't know why I always use the example, but I'm always like, what if the like creators, you've done a piece of content with a parent or a family member or a partner, and then something's happened to that partner, or something's happened to that, you know, it's always good to have that relationship, have that idea of what's going on, have that, you know, connecting in terms of usage rights and making sure that we're being appropriate with the content.
My dad recently got have you bought your Mother's Day card yet? Mother's dead.
It's Bloom and Wild send out an email that asks you if you would like their message. You can opt in or opt out for there, which is I think a very kind and sensitive the least that brands could do, I think it was nice to see them make that step to do that kind of thing. But those are the exact kind of ethics and governance that we can be thinking about, that we can make sure that we're protecting people that we're working with.
Yeah. Talked about TikTok.
Yep.
What about YouTube Shorts? Big year of YouTube Shorts, putting a lot of marketing.
I haven't seen much of it. I haven't seen much conversation around it. I haven't seen many creators speaking about it.
I know that monetization came out last monetization came out on the 1st of February this year. But it was announced that they were going to be bringing it in last year.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. I think there's still, as a creator, you're making more in AdSense.
Right.
Than you can make more from the platform than you can from TikTok at the moment, excluding brand partnerships. but it's still nowhere near a long form YouTube video.
I think my feedback that I've had from this about any kind of platform with monetization is that a lot of creators then find it makes them either kind of have to bend to the algorithm, bend to whatever is required of them to do those things, or it could be taken away, that kind of reliance on going through that platform. I mean, don't get me wrong, YouTube videos and longevity of their shelf life is incredible compared to, I mean, a TikTok, you post it and let's be honest, a month later, not as watched.
Pinterest as well is a good one for evergreen bits.
Yeah, brilliant for it. Great for search as well. Mm. Also, Pinterest brought out a really great feature of, I saw this the other day, there was a girl who, this actually came up on my TikTok feed the other day. This was two videos kind of quite close to each other. One video of a girl, she was searching braid hairstyles. Mm-hmm. And in YouTube and in Google, she had to put everything she was searching for had to be added with four black girls, everything. If she put braid hairstyles, it would come up with white blonde hair, straight, you know, type one hair.
Interesting.
But to get different hair types, to get 4C, 3B, like whatever, curly kinky hair, she had to put in for black girls. Pinterest have a special thing. If you put in a search, it has little buttons and you can specify your search options by hair type. Which has a visibility of like, and you can literally click which one you want to see. And I just thought that's such a great, easy option for people to be really inclusive within there. Well, probably not easy. Sorry, I wasn't there developing that for Pinterest. Yeah, but but just a great example of how we can be inclusive in our social platforms.
You just don't hear much noise from Pinterest, you know, and they do have a creator team and people. But they built in monetization at one point and then I think they removed it. I don't know then if it came back again. I know they have a creator team, but sort of in the, I don't know, are you getting any briefs for Snapchat coming through?
Pinterest is an interesting one. I went to a talk from Pinterest like 3 years ago. I remember walking out of the talk and being like, wow, like I was really impressed by that. And then just not hearing anything else again. And I think
I've had the same thing.
Just I think when you do get in contact with them, when you do,
I don't think it's a massive team though. In the UK at least.
Yeah, I guess it's just not the powerhouse.
Yeah.
That the other ones are, but I think that it's still. I mean, people are using it for conversion because the built-in links for that and the searchability on it. I think it's definitely in terms of a full
maybe they
funnel
haven't,
option.
Yeah, made. As much of a fuss around the like creator community on and those sort of programs.
It was not kind of like where Snapchat you've got curated creator highlights and things where you're going and watching certain people's stories and things like that. It's much more needs led by I need to find this versus a TikTok platform, which is I'm going to serve you entertainment.
What is your favorite platform?
I've had to put a time limit on TikTok. Yeah. I ignore it every single day. It's really bad. That's not my favourite.
Yeah, but the most addictive though.
It is the most, those little hits.
How do you feel about, the sort of addictiveness of social media and that, actually this was sort of in a conversation that I heard earlier, that the attention that they're asking from us and the amount of time that we're giving, is that morally right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I mean, the free will of humans is kind of, we kind of take what's in front of us and run. I think it's very difficult for us to kind of be policing it and managing it of like how much. I think the key is I always want to be adding value to someone's life.
Yeah.
And being true about what the value is that you're adding. You know, I always say this about influencer marketing is that you can only have such good influencer marketing if your product isn't serving a real need, isn't actually like a good thing, then, you know, you're not adding value to people's lives. You know, you can get people to talk about it. Those authentic third-party recommendations, they just won't be there. And I think that that's the important thing about social and our role as people who are creating brand deals on the spaces and benefiting from the spaces is to make sure that we're adding value to people's lives.
Yeah, you kind of can see when something launches and they've done a round of funding and it's only people that are obviously being paid a lot. And yes, you need to raise awareness, but that sort of window, there is, you know, building stuff up over time and having a product that is so good that actually I did a I hosted a panel at Ogilvy years ago, and I think it was Hector Bellerin from Arsenal, who was on it, and he said that the only campaigns that he does are the ones that he would have done for free anyway, because that's how aligned it has to be. And I thought that was quite interesting.
That's funny. I saw a panel with Jill Scott, and she said something very similar.
Oh, really? Yeah, maybe it's working, a football thing.
Yeah, it's a football thing. She was working on, I think it was Sterling the Bank.
Starling?
Yeah, Starling the Bank. Yeah, she was like, well, we've all already got it. So it made perfect sense. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that's, you know, you can make an influencer aware that your products exists, but yeah, that proper, if you would do it free, you're actually engaged in it. It's actually something that you would use and you're interested in. That authenticity and protecting that integrity of that relationship, I think, should be of utmost importance to all of us.
Do you work across banks at Mindshare?
Yes, BlackRock.
Okay.
Yes.
Because there has been a big rise in sort of financial creators as well, and financial well-being. I think it's a good move, you know.
Yeah.
I think the education system has been flawed, learning about Pythagoras' theorem, but not how to fill in your tax return.
Absolutely. I have no idea how to attach to them. Thank you, Mindshare team, for doing all of my taxes every year. I appreciate you. It is an interesting one, and you do see more kind of pieces coming out of people educating around finance, and especially if we're getting into the cost of living crisis or cozy lives, as the Gen Z are calling it.
So what has the impact of that been on your marketing sort of advice and on the campaigns that, you know, I've seen some contracts that it's like sensitivity to cost of living, but and budgets are on the whole, have you found that some of them have been paused, or people aren't deploying it, just waiting to see threat of recession?
I don't believe so, in terms of people kind of really pausing or reducing or putting a brake on massively. I think it's still kind of at the moment be a kind of, you know, everything that we do, we're playing cautiously, and we're making sure that we're getting the most out of it, and that we're working to our ultimate efficiencies. I haven't seen the biggest impact that I've personally seen has been the layoffs and things at all the different tech partners, because then that's who we're kind of working with and having conversations with. So lots of changeovers and things like that there. But no, not in
which I suppose just delays some things or makes it.
As we say, Pinterest having a small team, if you're going to have a smaller team, there's going to be less conversation, and just about making sure that you've got those smooth and effective lines of communication between everyone you're working with.
Do you have those? You said you spent the most time on TikTok, but it wasn't necessarily your favorite. So what is your favorite personally, and your favorite, like, what makes a good relationship with the likes of YouTube and those teams? Like, what do you want to hear from them? Like, how does it work?
I mean, I love hearing from different platforms, the programs that they have to support their creators, their understanding of organic and paid, and kind of the relationship that holds, the different ad formats and capabilities, and how they're kind of supporting that side of it. I think it's okay for them to tie in with, you know, oh, we're going to put a 6-second video before your YouTube play kind of piece.
Yeah.
But in terms of their focus on the content that's bringing people to that platform, the influencer content, the creator content that's bringing people to their platforms, I love to see them when they have a passion and an interest to protect, safeguard, and boost their creators within their channels in a really effective way.
In terms of what your goals are within the role over the next sort of 12, 18 months, what do you sort of hope to achieve at Mindshare?
We are having a look at exactly kind of what our role is and how we can best support clients. You know, we have some really great capabilities across in different pockets, in different markets, and it's just in terms of having a specific kind of influencer person within the global team, that was new to my role. So having that visibility of what's going on and seeing exactly where we fit in.
Do you feel like you're having to have conversations to make some stakeholders understand like the value of it, or do you think that it's just going to become a bigger and bigger part of sort of mindshare and the campaigns that are happening?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to come a bigger part. We definitely see like more and more conversations and more interest in it. There's education at every level because it keeps changing as well. So as we learn more things, we're having to educate and go through and pass on those learnings that we're getting consistently from either from the markets or from the platforms or from, you know, the wider media business. And I think in terms of people being interested in it, I mean, there's huge demand. People see it so much in their personal and daily lives that it becomes kind of a natural question and a natural piece to develop. And just making sure that we're doing it effectively and properly, because it is, it's a different type of media, because it's a human, and that means that we are involving entirely different kind of processes and vetting and in terms of how we're tracking and working with them and actually understanding what's happening on their platforms and what's happening with their relationships with their with their audiences, you know. And Billboard doesn't have a relationship with its with its audience,
yeah,
but your creator has a very deep, nuanced, you know, will have memes, will have commitments to their creators and to their audiences that it's really important to understand. And I think that's the depth of it that we're trying to just really.
Do you find that some people are just trying to make it performance only when it
some people who are their entire role is commerce or yeah. performance, obviously they're really interested in that side of it, but then you have other people that see the value in having it as an awareness piece. And I think it's because I work with so many different people, so many different brands, so many different things, I can have a conversation where I can think of an example of one person who's doing it one way and one person who's doing it a completely different way, and one person who isn't convinced by it and one person who couldn't be more excited and passionate about it and wants to kind of drive it forward. So it's a really nice challenge to have that real balance, and to have those constant conversations with different people to have your finger on the pulse so much of how different people are thinking about it, from like our APAC teams are doing just fantastic and wonderful stuff. I was chatting with Turkey the other day, who's doing some really great stuff. Sent me a video of this influencer has a really great relationship with the seagull outside of his window, and they utilized that as part of their campaign. It was a really great campaign, and I was like, that's so random, but okay.
Well, actually, many years ago I had to do a news story when I was at a newspaper, obviously, about seagulls being bigger and bolder than ever before. And so my story, I had to go down to Brighton and then I got attacked by a seagull. So the relationship wasn't as good. But yeah, seagulls.
Add that to your LinkedIn. Yeah. Professionally attacked by a seagull.
The trouble is then you wake up the next day, see the newspaper, and the pictures that accompany the pieces are not that great.
They're terrifying. So, they're massive.
Yeah, they're huge.
They're huge.
Because it had killed a dog and a pet tortoise. Not this specific one, but no. You know.
You found that
really
one.
Good. That's very investigative reporting. I found the culprit.
Yeah. This is the one, officer. Get him.
Take it. You mentioned earlier that somebody from social is working with a virtual influencer.
Yes, yeah.
Virtual influencers.
Yeah, Zero by Nexus. Yeah, very. So a VTuber, actually. So someone who is wearing kind of a suit.
Right.
And live streams. And as they live stream, their avatar kind of gets embodied onto them. So they can have live interactions with people.
Do you think that's the future of the virtual influencer space? I was talking about virtual influencers definitely like 4 or 5 years ago. And people were like, this is going to be great because then brand safety's, you know, no problem whatsoever.
But there is absolutely, if you dig hard enough, please don't, anyone listening, a video of me on Goat's social, maybe I'll delete it at some point. Harry, if you're listening, delete it. Is me saying virtual influencers, I don't believe it. Like, how can they be authentic? It's crazy. Like, I don't get it. And that was because I was coming from a personal perspective of I would not potentially engage with them. However, I think it's quite a Western view, because then we look at APAC, we look at Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, doing some really interesting stuff. Brazil as well, doing some really interesting stuff with virtual influencers. And it really is working because they have a real engagement with with the avatars, with the personalities that are on there. My personal issue had been them working on, say, for example, a hair care brand and showing off their shiny hair.
Yeah.
That I was like...
Do you think, though, although it's working really well there, does that necessarily mean, you know, that those countries are ahead and that's the way we're going? Like, normally we look to the US. It's like, if it's in there in the US, like, 2-3 years, that's what it's going to be here. But I don't necessarily get that crossover.
It's going off in different routes. I mean, we look at, like, China has gone off and it's completely its own branch. And I think that we'll see the same with kind of APAC. It is really kind of going off in its own branch. And it's not necessarily that the future is going to be virtual, because that's what's happening in Singapore right now. I think, and if we looked at Singapore like, what, 4 or 5 years ago, they actually weren't as developed as kind of the UK market. So, to have those conversations on who's more developed, it's kind of just more like, how is each market adapting their strategies and their creative concepts to fit the interests of the audiences and of these online communities? And when we look at them instead of like as leading trends, and we look at them instead as fostering the audiences and the communities that exist within those markets, I think that that's a kind of a better way to consider it. And then we give each one credit instead of saying, oh, you're behind. It's like, or actually, are you catering? Are you supporting what your audience and what your market wants and needs?
A big thanks to Esme for coming on the show.